Good morning. Happy Easter. All right, happy spring. What a perfect Easter morning. In Zen Buddhism, we say life is not killed. And every spring seems to kind of point to that, I think, don't you think? Isn't it nice to see it back? And we say birth and death do not appear, although it appears to be so. And to me, Easter is about not being bound by death. Not being bound by our ideas, our fixed ideas about death. Seeing through our ideas about death. And that's really the heart of Zen practice, actually, is seeing through life and death. The alleviation of suffering by seeing reality more clearly. More clearly. So this morning, I'm going to talk to you about a passage from Hongzhe, the Chinese Zen master from the late 11th century, early 12th century, and the verse is on the front of your program, for those of you who have one. The translation I'm using is the only one that I'm aware of. It's by Taigen Layton, and it's from a book called Cultivating the Empty Field, which we actually studied here, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, something like that. It's a really nice text. It's relatively short, and the parts in it that are actually written by Hongzhe are pretty short. It's maybe 50 pages. Maybe not even that. Actually, most of it's commentary. But it's very, very nice. And he kind of comes into play about 500 years after Bodhidharma takes Buddhism, Zen Buddhism, to China. So he's about 500 years into the Chinese era of Zen. And he's a couple generations before Dogen, and he had a lot of influence on Dogen. Dogen liked his writings quite a bit. So anything that heavily influences Dogen, therefore heavily influences Soto Zen, and therefore heavily influences us. So that's why I'm talking a little bit about him. I like his stuff a lot. And what I'm going to talk to you about is the first half of his first practice instruction. So he has practice instructions, and he has verses. And you would think that practice instruction would imply kind of nuts and bolts. Well, practice instruction. And it does. But the language to me is very, and maybe this is the translation, maybe this is Taigen in there too, but the translation to me feels almost like prose poetry. I mean, yeah, there's instruction there, and you can see when you unpack it that it's based on an extensive knowledge of Buddhist teachings in different schools and that kind of stuff. And the way he weaves them together is just masterful. But what I like about it is it conveys to me a feeling, kind of a felt sense. So it feels a little more like poetry to me, a little more like art. And that's what I always hope that good Dharma teaching does, is leave me with a felt sense, you know? More than just more ideas in my noodle. I mean, that's helpful too, right? I mean, my brain needs food, I get that, but I'm the most moved by stuff that is intellectually fascinating, but also leaves me with that kind of feeling. So I hope some of that comes across today as you spend time with this verse, because it's really, really nice. So for those of you who do not have it in front of you, I'll read it for you, and this is what we're talking about today. It's called The Bright Boundless Field. The field of boundless emptiness is what exists from the very beginning. You must purify, cure, grind down, or brush away all the tendencies you have fabricated into apparent habits. Then you can reside in the clear circle of brightness. Utter emptiness has no image. Upright independence does not rely on anything. Just expand and illuminate the original truth unconcerned by external conditions. Accordingly, we are told that not a single thing exists. In this field, birth and death do not appear. So, we'll just go through it today, line by line, and we'll see. See what comes. So he starts with the field of boundless emptiness is what exists from the very beginning. That's so nice. Actually, that could be the whole thing. It really actually could be. Everything else is sort of just perseverating in a way on that. I'm kind of guessing that maybe Dogen was familiar with this line because it gives me the same feeling as the first line of Dogen's Genjo Koan. The way is originally perfect and all-pervading. They have the same sort of energy to me. The way is originally perfect and all-pervading. The field of boundless emptiness is what exists from the very beginning. So when Hongzhe talks about the field of boundless emptiness, he's talking about mind. Right? This poem is a practice instruction. So this is supposed to be, it is, kind of hard dharma. Right? So he's giving you the starting point. This is a practice instruction, and he's talking about working with the mind. Right? So much of what we do here, right? Working with the mind. And if you're new to Buddhism, if you're new to Zen Center this morning, the term mind in this context roughly equates to consciousness itself. It doesn't just mean the 3 pounds of gray between your ears, right? It's not just brain. Mind in Buddhism incorporates feelings, memory, sensations, thoughts, of course, perceptions, the whole thing. The body of your awareness is mind, right? The awakeness of being. And in this context, the term emptiness roughly means complete spaciousness, complete flow, change, beyond all of our usual concepts or fixed views, beliefs, and anything that pushes us beyond our normal tendency to concretize, right, or reify, or lock something in. Emptiness in Buddhism is just about the condition of things never being fixed or permanent. It's about flow, essentially. There's other ways of talking about it, but for today, that's the way we're going to work with it. The metaphor that's oftentimes given is to talk about this is wave and water, the relationship between wave and water. We have an idea of wave. I know what a wave is. Looks like this. It's a real thing. It has a birth. It has a death. It exists. Wave. And when we look closely at wave, we realize that's sort of shorthand to describe a specific phenomenal shape, but that specific phenomenal shape is shifting, flowing, changing, and it's just water. So it's real. It's just not locked in. Does that make sense? Kind of? I'm seeing about half nods and about half, what are you? Well, it's a Zen center. It's kind of what you get here. Anyway, so this is our starting point in Soto Zen practice. The original, perfect, and boundless emptiness of all-pervading mind. That's where we start. There's a lot there. The original, perfect, boundless emptiness of all-pervading mind. And, of course, mind is just a concept, too. Right? It's just as empty as wave. It's just a concept. So the field of boundless emptiness is also non-mind. But when this is our... The reason this is important here and the reason this has had such an impact on Soto Zen practice for over 1,000 years is because when this is our starting point in practice, it defines our relationship with practice, with Zazen, with our mind, with our life, in a very different way than if we start practice with the traditional sort of samsara nirvana dualism, right? The samsara nirvana dualism from traditional Buddhism, it's still folded in there. It's not that it's negated. But you can sort of feel, I hope, just sort of feel the difference between this is really suffering and I need to do this thing to get me free from it, is different than our starting point is that everything pervades everything and is fundamentally, originally okay. There's a difference there. There's just a different feel to it for me. And of course it changes our relationship with Zazen itself, because meditation or Zazen is both a means to an end. Yeah, it's the thing I do to get rid of the impurities and the suffering. It's a means to an end. But it's also the end. Right? If the nature of mind is perfect and all-pervading, what are you trying to fix? Right? And this was Dogen's. Dogen is the founder of Soto Zen. He's the founder of our school. This was his great koan. If we all have Buddha nature, if everything is fundamentally okay, why do we need to practice? That's a really, really good question. I encourage all of you to spend time with that question, because his answer is not your answer. Because we've all heard this same idea in all the different faith traditions. That, you know, the kingdom of God spread out upon the earth. This is perfect. Everything is fine. All shall be well. Wow. And you're like, but no, I'm pretty sure it's not. I'm pretty sure this stinks a lot of the time. What's your deal? I mean, right? And that's something really worth spending time on. Right? Because people have been saying this for thousands of years, and these are people we don't consider to be tripped out or out of it. They're people we consider to be wide awake. There must be something to what they're saying. You know? So it's not that, well, if you're suffering, you're doing it wrong. It's more of look closely. Look very, very closely and see. So that's always the invitation of Zen practice, of Buddhist practice. I think of all spiritual practice, really. And our questions that come up when we hear this kind of thing are the questions we're supposed to have. Encourage those questions. Encourage that doubt. But engage with it, you know. So when Dogen was told, mind is perfect and all-pervading, you've got Buddha nature, there's, you know, everything is fine, and I'm supposed to sit in meditation every day for an hour, or two, or three, or four, why? That's a really good question. In fact, that's why he went to China in the first place and met with these types of teachings, was to try to figure out what that was. The everything's just fine answer was too easy for him. He had to feel it, experience it, right? So encourage your questions about this. What do you think about that? Can this life, as you experience it, with all of its very, very real pain, suffering, grief, be perfect? That's your question. Can your contentment include suffering? That's a good question. Have you ever experienced in your life a moment of contentment in the midst of struggle, dissatisfaction, pain? I mean, is that possible? These are pretty good questions, right? Because usually we think of them as being diametrically opposed, right? Freedom, nirvana, whatever, is the absence of any kind of difficulty whatsoever. So the more of these difficulties I get rid of in my life, oh, I'm making progress. I'm getting there, right? So looking at that really, really closely is one of the invitations of Zen practice. So our relationship to our experience as it is crucially important. Right? Our relationship to our experience as it is crucially important. That's one of the great functions of Zazen, is recognizing how much time we spend wanting what is to be different than what is. Right? Recognizing that tendency in ourselves and returning. That's one of the crucial functions. So he goes on. You must purify, cure, grind down, or brush away all the tendencies you have fabricated into apparent habits. Then you can reside in the clear circle of brightness. So this is why we practice, which is to know and experience the clear circle of brightness. It's also how we practice, purify, cure, grind down and brush away. And those four words are interesting, right? Purify sort of suggests impurity, right? And cure suggests disease. And grind down suggests obstacle, right, or impediment. And brush away suggests dirt or dust. So all of a sudden we've got four action words. And there's something to do. That's pretty interesting. I just think it's interesting because he just said, well, the field of awareness is pure and boundless and perfect from the beginning. And now he's saying, so now you've got to purify, cure, ground. What? I mean, come on, what are you telling me here? Do I have to do something or do I not? I'm always hoping not. But there is something to do, a path to follow, a practice, despite the boundless field. Perfection contains imperfection. And, you know, he says fabricated tendencies and apparent habits. And I like these two phrases because this is both observing the objects of mind, which we would say as tendencies, right? Habits, observing those things. Oh, yeah, this is what my brain tends to do. Oh, I have the same emotional response whenever I see so-and-so. I'm observing, right? I'm just seeing them. Oh, this is that habit. I get it. There's an object of my consciousness. I'm observing it. But at the same time, he's delivering to you the idea that those objects are empty because it's fabricated tendencies and it's apparent habits. You know, look very closely at a habit. What exactly is that? Isn't it just one thing? Well, but it comes up over and over. Oh, okay, so now you're bringing in future and past. Oh, okay, that's interesting. Oh, but I'm creating this thing. It's a habit, you see, it's real. Look at that really carefully. Fabricated, apparent. So he's just sort of not letting us reify even the idea that we have habits, that we have tendencies. Not to say they're not real, but not to reify them, not to solidify and concretize them. Because both the objects of mind and mind itself are empty. And because he's reminding us of that here, all we're really brought back to is the clear circle of brightness again. This fundamental, omnipresent consciousness, wide awake. Objects and that which observe objects are both wide awake. Luminous is a word he uses a lot, not in this verse, but empty. Empty. And I think everybody, in fact, I won't say I think, everybody has experienced the clear circle of brightness. It sounds very lofty. I like lofty language because it is inspirational to me. But really all he's talking about is a very common human experience. It's not unique to Buddhists. It's not unique to meditators. But it's just the experience when you saw clearly what was, the moment as it was. You just saw it clearly, and you didn't want anything to be different. That's really it. When you were just present, and you knew it was, and you saw it, and you didn't want to change it, and you were just there with it. Right? That's really all it is. We would say that's contentment. I think, isn't contentment just not wanting anything to be different? Right? So that, can that include suffering and pain? Can that include contents of consciousness? Can that include a busy mind? Can that include the person next to you during zazen who's breathing too heavy, or the car horn, or whatever, right? Can it? And that's up to you. I mean, it can or it can't. Obviously, you're seeing this question the same way we all are. Just how do you, oh, it's when I catch myself wanting to exclude that, wanting to jump in and kick that out and say, that's unacceptable and this is acceptable. Ah, now I've gone down the rabbit hole. I'm just laughing because it's what we do all the time. So, he goes on. Utter emptiness has no image, and upright independence does not rely on anything. Just expand and illuminate the original truth, unconcerned by external conditions. Utter emptiness has no image. Utter emptiness. So that makes sense, right? If we're talking about emptiness being the lack of fixed self, just flow, it doesn't have a fixed image. But in actual practice, this is hard for me to sort of see, because I wouldn't think that I would be able to, because he's using the term image in this case, he's using the field of the senses, kind of a visual sense, it could be anything, but I wouldn't think we'd be able to see that which doesn't have fixed form or abiding nature. But we do, right, all the time. We see things that are nothing but flow. So the me that's sitting here in front of you, right now I am not fixed or permanent or substantially abiding, but you see me. So does the subtlety of your seeing include time? The passage of time. So my question is, are you seeing a fixed me, or are you just seeing change? You're just seeing emptiness. Do you just see flow? Completely unobstructed. Right? That's moment. Moment, we would say. Just flow. Completely unobstructed, regardless of the contents of it. It's just flow. It's just change. It's just emptiness. Wow. No fixed image. It's just shifting all the time. I think that's maybe why photographs are so fascinating. You know, because like that can't happen. And you're like, I'm actually able to hold a moment of time and look at all the little tiny... Isn't that kind of cool? I think it's one of the reasons photographs are so evocative, because this can't in any way happen in the field of our senses. It's, in a sense, in a weird way, it's like unnatural. Like, all there is flow, and somehow I'm able to do this thing that isn't flow. And it's like, what? That's impossible. It's cool, isn't it? Upright independence does not rely on anything. So moment is upright, and moment is independent. So this moment, we're sitting together here in the Zendo on Easter Sunday. This moment has no image that is fixed, right? It has no fixed quality. If someone tells you later, what was your experience like at Zen Center? You can say, oh, it's good. So that's one of probably 10,000 things you actually experienced. Oh, it was good. And it was boring. Then it was exciting. Then it was confusing. Then it was boring again. Then I was really thirsty. And then I was thinking about last summer's vacation to the lake. Then I was bored again. Then I mean, it's just happening. It has no fixed. And what did it look like? Well, first it looked like this, and then it looked like this, and then it looked like this, and then, you know, whoosh. It does not rely on anything. So when he says this moment does not rely on anything, I was puzzled by that, because we think of everything in Buddhism being interdependent. Everything is co-created. Everything is co-arising at once, right? Which is true. And at the at the same time, on the other hand, he's saying this moment isn't in any way dependent on another different, separate moment. What would that be? How could it be? That's sort of absurd, right? It doesn't come from anything. This moment is a complete expression. It's a complete expression. It's upright. It's a complete expression. And this idea, this upright independence, not relying on anything, the spirit of this, Dogen really carries forward in his Zazen instructions and Fukan Zazengi. I think this is part of why we sit up straight. Right, there's practical reasons we sit up straight during Zazen, because you know it's better for your breathing and it's better for your circulation and da 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 da. I mean, it's just much more comfortable to sit up straight. But I think sort of philosophically speaking, it's the shape of your mind. You're upright. You're independent. You're not leaning on anything. That's the nature of your mind. Balance. Right? For a lot of us, that's the only time we sit up straight during the whole day. For a lot of us, it's the only time we sit up straight during the day, or aren't leaning on something. Isn't there something just even about that that feels good in a strange way? Even if it's unusual to you, even if it isn't entirely comfortable, it's maybe good beyond comfortable, there's something about just feeling your body be upright. You know, I don't have to look elsewhere for balance, or equanimity, or not leaning, or not grabbing, or not avoiding, because it's right here. In my actual bones and muscles, even if my mind is all over the place. I'm sitting up straight. Isn't that nice? I think it's nice. So, just expand and illuminate the original truth, unconcerned by external conditions. This is like his Zazen instruction to me. Just expand and illuminate what's already here. What's already here. what you already are. We would say things as it is. Just what's here. Just expand and illuminate. So expand, for me here, means just to allow and to hold. I like the term expand because, you know, when there's something in the field of my experience I don't like, I want to exclude it. And so I feel like, in a sense, I've just gotten smaller. I'm not big enough to hold that. I don't like barking dog noise or car noise or whatever memories of something I don't like or back pain or whatever, right? I want to be safe from it by excluding it. I like expand because it's sort of like, no, you can be big enough to hold that too. It doesn't have to throw you off. Breathe into it. Can you be just a little bigger? Can you hold it? Just hold it. You don't have to fix it. It's not a problem. Right? It only becomes a problem when I think I need to fix it. You don't have to fix it. Just see it. Just breathe into it. Can you just be with it? So I love that. Allowing, holding, that's implied in his term expand. And illuminate, expand and illuminate. Illuminate just means to see with kindness. Really, I mean, the kindness is mine. I'm adding that, but gee whiz. Isn't that sort of nice? I don't know. I really do think there's a quality of awareness in Zazen that is intrinsically kind. And it doesn't have a narrative. It isn't like, oh, what a beautiful floor. Oh, what beautiful back pain. Oh, what beautiful, you know. No. There's not a dialogue about it. It's just there's a softness to it. Grandmotherly mind is what I always think of. I love the phrase grandmotherly mind. I want to say that was Dogen. Was that Dogen? Do you think grandmotherly mind, Ted?
I don't know.
Rosemary, do you know?
She's so ceremonial.
It does.
I'm not grandma.
Well, my grandma was fabulous. So I love this term because it always reminds me of the way that she just received me. No matter what. Like, no matter what. Skinned knee, really painfully stupid haircut. An idea about what I wanted to do that day that was something she wasn't interested in. Just that sort of, wow, just that unconditional kindness. That's all we're talking about. We could say love. That's a strong word. But I like kind. They both work. Illuminate just means to see with kindness. And that is the invitation on the cushion. You're just observing with kindness. There it is. There it is. There's my racing brain today. There's my heart being turbulent because I'm not sure. There's that twinge in the knee that always comes up. Oh, there's my anxiety that maybe something's wrong with my knee and I won't be able to sit Zazen in 10 years. There it is, right? It's empty, right? My anxiety about it's empty, but I sure feel it. It's sure there. Can I just be gentle? And I think that's really the question on the cushion. Can we just breathe into these experiences of being alive and hold them? Without leaning away, you know, without leaning toward and wanting to fix or wanting to make them different somehow. If we can leave our agenda out of it, if we can just illuminate and expand with gentle awareness, can we do that? And if you can do that, your experience of being alive will change. Your experience of being alive on this planet will change if you can do that. And the transformative agent is just your simple, no agenda, kind attention. That's it. It's not even, you could even say it's not even you doing it. It's not you improving your experience. We always inject ourselves into it. That's why I'm laughing. But your experience changes. Experience changes. So Dogen says, between aspiration, practice, enlightenment, and nirvana, there is not a moment's gap. Continuous practice is the circle of the way. And if practice is a circle, then we never start or finish, right? If you're on a circular path, every step you take is the first one and the last one, right? There's not a starting point or an ending point. It's a circle. That's the cool thing about the circle, right? So if practice is a circle, you never start, you never finish. And if you never arrive at practice, if you never finish with practice, then you're never separated from practice. Right? You're it. You're it. And it's you. And you are practice enlightenment. That's it. You just are that. Practice becomes the activity of enlightenment itself. So illuminating the original truth, to use his term here in the verse, illuminating the original truth for the very first time is already illuminating all of it. Right? When you take one step on a circle, you're on the entire thing. Right? The whole thing. That's our zazen. So this is, you can see why this predates Dogen. It's very Shikan Taza, it's very Soto Zen. The relationship with zazen is there's no problems to solve, there's nothing in particular even to observe, really. Mind, you could argue, isn't really even an object. Just sitting, silently illuminating, and being illuminated by what is, which is us. And he says, unconcerned by external conditions, which makes a lot of sense. This is sort of spiritual security in Zen Buddhism, I would say. This is sort of spiritual security, which is not relying on the changing conditions of life for contentment. It's not the way we mostly live, most of us, most of the time. Most of us, most of the time, are trying to arrange the externals in our lives to line up in such a way that we experience what we call contentment. That's what we do. But the Buddhist challenge, the Zen point of view, is that being upright in the midst of things, moment to moment, with what is spiritual security. It's my capacity to expand and illuminate. It's my capacity to be upright, to be with what is. There's spiritual security. So it's very self-reliant in that way. And the responsibility is mine, which is wonderful and horrible. I mean, that's how I experience it, depending on whether or not it's easy that day. So resting in things as it is, and that's just going back again to that experience everybody here has had, wanting nothing to be different. Even if it was only 5 seconds, I know everybody's had that experience, wanting nothing to be different when everything was just fine. So our last two lines this morning are very challenging. Accordingly, we are told that not a single thing exists. In this field, birth and death do not appear. Not a single thing exists. Well, gee, it sure seems like it. Not to argue with the Zen master, but that looks like a podium to me. No birth, no death in this field. Birth and death do not appear. Well, that was our starting point this morning, right? Birth and death. And being told there's no birth and no death, or that birth and death aren't what you think, or birth and death do not appear, or you are invited to see through birth and death, these are hard teachings for us to accept. They just are. In fact, I think they're more than hard. I think any of us who has ever been present at a birth or a death doesn't ever forget it. You know, as humans, I'm convinced this is like the two most real things that are to us. I really think they actually frame all of our experience of being alive. We are convinced we are, and we will die. Those are the two things. Right? I was born, I am, this is real, and someday it won't be. And all of my questions essentially come from there. My fears come from there, my hopes come from there. Everything comes from those two things. So they are the most real things in all of experience for us humans. They just are. And Zen Buddhism calls this the great matter. The great matter, or sometimes the great matter of birth and death. Sometimes the great problem of birth and death, which is, actually feels a little more accurate, frankly. And these are the same things every tradition wrestles with. I mean, every human wrestles with them on some level, consciously or not, and it's certainly what our faith traditions are designed to explore. Norm Fisher, he's a contemporary Zen teacher, for those of you who don't know, he's fabulous. He was here a number of months ago, and he said, somebody asked him about how, I forget the question, but what he was saying was, the only reason we have religion is because we die. And the more I thought, I was like, well, it can't be that easy. But then the more I thought about it, I was like, yeah, that's pretty much it. And it does other stuff too, but that's, you know, if we didn't die, then all of the questions that religions are designed to help us answer would be, who cares? Right? So I'm like, oh, that's interesting. The great matter of birth and death. And, of course, that's what the Easter story in the Christian tradition is addressing, like one of these absolutes. You know, is death really an absolute? Like always, always, always? And in a larger sense, does the reality of death negate the point of life, the meaning of life? Does the fact we die make all this completely pointless? If you're into the French existentialists, that's something they love spending a lot of time with. Ennui. It's a very good question. It's worth spending time with. And I think you could say that the Easter myth of somebody coming back to life is on some level about our egoic desire to defeat death. I know I'm real. I can defeat even death and live forever. Or at least I can ally myself with somebody who can, right? And I get that. Yeah, I think that level exists, sure. But that actually seems like kind of shortchanging a greater potential of that story. Because we are told life is not killed. How can this be true? I mean, is that really true? In his notes to case number 13 of the Mumen Kan, which is the Gateless Gate Koan collection in Zen, there's this very short story. Zen Master Ganto was the abbot of a large temple and was killed by looters who plundered it. Finding Ganto alone doing zazen after all the other monks had fled, the thieves murdered him. As he was being killed, he gave a great shout, which is said to have resounded for many miles. This shout proved a great problem to many monks in later years, including Hakuin Zenji, who could not understand the shout's meaning. The problem was solved for Hakuin at the moment of his enlightenment, and he cried out, "Oh, Ganto is still alive, strong and healthy." That's pretty cool. So is Ganto, like, literally, physically still alive? No, of course not. Hakuin lived like 1,000 years after Ganto. This is one of those Easter stories that is helping us to look at what is your usual idea about death? What is your usual assumption about the absolutes in your life? And you'll notice, and this is, I love this about Zen, you'll notice that the problem of Ganto's shout was solved only for Hakuin when he was enlightened. It wasn't solved for anybody else. In other words, the emphasis in Zen is always on your experience. My answer is not your answer. I can give you an answer, and that's fine. But if you believe it, that's fine too. You just have a belief. Cool. You've probably got a long list of beliefs. Very nice. Is that change? It's lovely. It's not bad, but it's like, does that allaying your fears about death? Well, when you look closely enough, no, probably not. No matter how cool you think I am, my opinion, my experience is just my opinion. It's just my experience. My ability to even convey that to you is so limited, right? Symbolic consciousness just has its edges. So direct experience for ourselves is what's required for this type of learning. It's not belief in someone else's experience. And I guess you could say that one of our kind of Easter teachings in Buddhism is the truth of shunyata, or emptiness. Again, to go back to the water and the waves. From the Heart Sutra is what we usually chant here, what we always chant here during our liturgy, but I always use the Heart Sutra as kind of the distillation of the teaching of emptiness. There's a lot of other sutras about it, but these few lines to me seem to address this question. All dharmas, and in this case, dharma just means a moment of experience. It just means everything. For now, let's just say it means everything. All dharmas are marked by emptiness. Therefore, given emptiness, there is neither ignorance nor extinction of ignorance, neither old age and death, nor the extinction of old age and death, no suffering, no cause, no cessation, no path, no knowledge, and no attainment. So the Heart Sutra says, the teaching of emptiness says, birth and death neither exist nor don't exist. And Dogen says, it is an established way in Buddha Dharma to deny that birth turns into death. Accordingly, birth is understood as no birth. Death is understood as no death. Birth is an expression complete this moment. Death is an expression complete this moment. They are like winter and spring. You do not call winter the beginning of spring, nor summer the end of spring. It's just the water wave thing all over again. Because we create ideas like water and we create ideas like wave, and I go down to the shore of Lake Calhoun, it is impossible for me to touch water without touching a wave. It is impossible for me to touch a wave without touching water. Right? They are the same thing, and yet they're different, because a wave is a wave. Right? That's interesting. We can affirm them both, we can negate them both, but what is the experience when I touch it? Birth and death, the flavor of birth and death. You all know this flavor because it's what's happening to you right now. Right? So Hongzhi says, Buddha says, Bodhidharma says, Dogen says, Katagiri says, Suzuki said, Tim says, all of our teachers are basically saying the same thing. Look closer. Past all of your ideas and all your beliefs, you are the field in which birth and death do not appear. You are the field of boundless emptiness. And can we believe them? I would suggest no, because believing them wouldn't help anyway. Right? We have to know for ourselves. And that's the reason we actually have to practice. And that's the reason we have to do our meditation and our investigation and our reading and our study. Because ultimately, the only reason that Buddhism exists at all is to help alleviate suffering. That's the only reason any of us are here. We only practice for the benefit of all beings. So the only reason we spend time with these abstract and often confusing and lofty-sounding teachings is because how much suffering we experience and how much we inflict upon others because we don't see clearly. That's really what it's all about. Can you just see a little more clearly? You will hurt less. You will hurt others less, right? That's why we're here. There is no other reason. It isn't about getting an idea in my head so I get to be super smart. Who cares? Super smart doesn't help me suffer less. It really doesn't. So for me, where all this leaves us this morning is with an invitation. What this practice instruction leaves us with, what Zazen leaves us with, is the invitation that's the same invitation that's in all Zen Buddhist practice instructions and poems and Dharma talks and liturgies and koans and rituals, which is the invitation to find out for yourself if those teachers are telling you the truth. You know, find out for yourself. The invitation of your teachers and the invitation of your practice, I actually think fundamentally the invitation of your life, is to know for yourself, in your direct experience, in your cells, beyond any doubt, right, with complete certainty, who you are. That's the invitation. What else is there? Right? Only you can do that. So that's the invitation. And that's about all I have to say. This has been an unusual Easter talk. I realize that hasn't featured bunnies or eggs or large stones being rolled away. And so this is a strange ending place for us this morning, I also realize. And maybe it's not an ending place, right? Maybe there was never a starting place, and maybe there is never an ending place ever. So thank you very much. If you have any questions, comments, something you'd like to share, we've got about 5 minutes or so before we'd like to wrap up, I think. Does anybody have anything? Yes.
What about the role of myths?
The role of legacy?
Yes, and I ask that from the standpoint that all the teachings that you're reading about are things that are handed down to us from others.
Mm-hmm.
And things that, in a sense, are incorporated into us from other people. I mean, your words will resonate with me today.
Mm-hmm.
They're incorporated into me, okay? And they are incorporated maybe into what my practice will be next week,
mm-hmm.
one way or another. And that's what I'm labeling as legacy. But if what you speak about the wave and the water, that nothing is permanent, everything is always changing, how do we reconcile my definition of legacy with that concept? I mean, if we as Buddhists are trying to end suffering for all other beings, okay?
Mm-hmm.
That is a mission. That is a form of legacy.
Mm.
And that's not impermanence. I mean, that's actually a goal.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some, in my mind, it's not an unkind or ungentle disconnect, but there is, to a certain extent,
mm-hmm.
a disconnect. Are you tracking with what
mm-hmm.
I'm saying?
Yeah. So the legacy itself, the teaching itself, the aspiration itself being a fixed star,
yes,
sort of.
Yeah. That's
yeah.
What I'm saying.
Yeah.
And I can handle the disconnect because our role is to end suffering. And
yeah.
Okay, but still.
So in a sense, we're saying like that could be seen as permanent, the aspiration, the goal. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Oh, that's an interesting idea. No, that's good. Being stumped is kind of a cool feeling. You know, the world looks just different all of a sudden, and it's not quite comfortable with its edges. Well, there's a lot of ways. That's a great question, and there's a lot of ways of working with it, I would imagine. I suppose the way I think of that, because you're right, I have actually a really intimate relationship with, I like the term legacy here, or the lineage, or the inheritance, you know, that you take on. And I have a really warm relationship with those things. And I think I do in my head think of aspiration, the ancestors, the teachings as kind of a star probably to steer by. I think at the beginning of my practice I saw them more as, to continue using the boat on the ocean metaphor, I kind of considered them to be like a port I might someday arrive at if I were lucky. And now I'm like, it's not quite that concrete. It's more of a direction in which. So kind of like a compass, rather. And I don't know, so maybe a compass needle is usually just sort of a little insecure because you know it's moving just a little bit. I'm pretty sure north is this way-ish. Maybe that's impermanence. It isn't really that or that. It's sort of floppy. It's a little bit of both. And, of course, the Dharma itself evolves. You know, I mean, a lot of what you're asking is really good because, like, well, if this is in the Pali Canon, that must be the thing. And the Heart Sutra, that's, Buddha never said that. Well, then it's almost more like the relationship between Newtonian math and then more like, oh, Einsteinian math and quantum theory. Well, does that negate the early thing or does that include it? Or are these actually moving targets? And what was skillful means to alleviate suffering 500 BC is so radically different than skillful means to alleviate suffering now. Boy, I'd say keep your eyes on the prize, but the prize is sort of faint and fuzzy, isn't it? Beings are numberless, vowing to freedom. Yeah, I guess you'd say that's fixed. And I suppose, in a sense, that's pretty loose, too, because I'm not really sure. Maybe it's like light, you know, it's a particle and a wave. Ah, there's my answer. There's my answer. Thank you for listening to me long enough to arrive at it. That's a non-answer. But I'm really comfortable with that. Yes, it's permanent. It's impermanent in its permanence. That's a great question. I just like exploring these things because it's so fun to think about. Thank you. Oh, thank you all very much this morning.